No, they've been hanging out with a lot of normal people. That's Satma, that's Satma. Ephraim, relax yourself. You want to deal with Satma? Come on.
I thought this was a good one, not Satma.
About what?
I don't understand why a scholar. He's a real scholar. He's not a scholar.
He's a genius. And whenever you're a genius, there's shtick that go with being a genius. That's the answer. I can tell you that my classmate, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Grach, when he was much younger, when I was living in Israel, but he was much younger, or maybe he was slightly before. Anyway, he traveled around to Europe, and he went under the name, he came into Switzerland where his family is, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was there. There were a number of Soloveitchiks there. He used the name Chaim Levitt. And he went to visit everyone. Levitt was his mother's maiden name. That's what I was taught. No, they didn't look for a passport. You walk into a shtubel, ich bin Chaim Levitt, ich bin da an Amerikaner, ich bazuch euch. What's the big deal? And he spoke in learning. And they say, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik or his children or his cousins, they said, das ken ich sein, ich muss sein a Soloveitchik, ich red wie a Soloveitchik. So you know what can I tell you? But let it be, because I have a world I want to do today. Now I want to finish out last week's lecture, and it's amazing. First of all, today is Monday, Yom HaZikaron, the 15th of April, 2013. One second. Today it's a very interesting day. Number one, it's a very sad day, and those of us that have lived here, as I said yesterday, I cannot tell you how many people I buried, acquaintances, students, children of students, people I encouraged to come in Aliyah, their children, girls I taught in Michlala. They're thinking of names as I speak. Terrorist activities. Don't have to go any further than Nav and David Applebaum. Ita Kupfel, that's Ita Tzur, was my student in Michlala, an Israeli girl, such Mesirat Nefesh, David and Navi, you all know. And B'motam Tzivu Lanu Et HaChayim, that's the only answer. And to dedicate ourselves to make Israel a greater place. And every Torah Jew, every Jew has to live here, but every Torah Jew, what excuse is there for a Jew who davens every day with a Chazener Einenu, who benches Uvenei Yerushalayim, not to live here? It's happening here. We're building here. We're creating here. Miracles are happening here. Baruch Hashem. And that's all we can say. We have to go further. B'motam tzivu lanu et hachayim. So today is Yom HaZikaron. And it's an interesting day because, number one, Yom HaTzmut can never fall again on Monday. Once it can never fall again on Monday, it solves the problem that I remember, that Morty remembers, you probably remember, every time Yom HaTzmut fell on Monday and Bahab falls on Monday. How do you say Bahab if it's Yom HaTzmut? So the Tzioni shuls, Tzioni, the shuls that we daven in used to say Bahab a week later. Because you got to say Bahab, you can't begin Habba'ah, Hey Bethe. So that's The Nazi initials, Taka said, Bahab and Yom HaTzmut. Now that Yom HaTzmut is the Chui because of Chilul Shabbos, which is really beautiful what they did here with Yom HaTzmut and Yom HaShoah. So now the question is, today is really Heyiyah. No, if today is Heyiyah, do you say Tachnan? Don't you say Tachnan? So I can only tell you, I say Tachnan. My minion said Tachnan, and no one will accuse my minion of not being a Zionist minion. They say Hallel with a bracha. I say Hallel without a bracha. But I say Menom the fun of Shira Chadasha. I'm a Talmud of the Rabbi. What can I tell you? I don't have to apologize. It doesn't affect my Zionist credentials, I believe. But should we say Tachnan? I'll tell you. The Mishnah in Megillah, HaMegillah Nikreit B'Yom Yud Aleph, Yud Bet, Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, Tetvav. So you see that Chazal could make Takanit to play around with Purim. If they could do that, then the Rabbanim today can make Takanit, particularly to save Chilul Shabbos, to play around with Yom HaTzmut. So I feel today is Yom HaZikaron. Not to say Tachnun and Yom HaZikaron, This bothers me. It's not Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is Korol Alay Moed Lishbar Et Bachurai. And the Rav said to me when I visited with him the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, Shabbos Chazon, Motzoi Shabbos was Tisha B'Av in 78, you can check it out. So the Rav said, you should come to visit me also on a Moed. So I said, Rebbe, today is a Moed too, Korol Alay Moed. You're right, you're right. You remember, that's the way the Rav would speak. You're right, you're right. Korol Alay Moed Lishbar Bachurai. So I said Tachnun today. There are shuls that don't say, and they claim like Tisha B'Av, we don't say. We don't say today, even though it's Yom HaZikaron. Okay, it's an open issue, but what can I tell you? We have a very negligent attitude towards Tachnun, and what Morty we were talking about before class. There's a shtibbel in Borough Park, which I'm an honorary member of. I daven there 5 weeks a year, and I know all the people there. I have many students there. Listen to my shiurim, and They have a calendar. They literally announce whose yard site it is. And most of the year, they're not saying Tachnun because they have so many yard sites. And you see calendars printed like that. I saw in the Shtiblach in Katamon, there's a calendar, 3 to 4 yard sites a day. So Megitta Klap, and you don't say Tachnun. Now, there's no question that what kind of college did Rabbi Revel envision, and you'll see in a minute how this becomes, which is beyond my words, the Hashgacha Pratit, a topic I speak about in class, becomes halacha lemaisa all over the world. And there's no question that Rabbi Revel didn't have time to think it out. And we're going to talk about that yet. We're going to come to problems in Yeshiva College and the opposition to Yeshiva College, and some of the problems are real. I don't want to be like one of those people who say, oh, there are no problems, sweep it under the carpet. The problems are real. We never yet had a yeshiva and a college under one roof, as far as I recall. But in my humble opinion, Rabbi Revel comes to the concept of yeshiva college long after he knows Shas and Efi Tosfat by heart. And I view him in the mold of Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, and there's actually a quote from Rabbi Revel. We don't want a Catholic college. And the Rav himself spoke against a Catholic college. And Yeshiva University until today, you may agree or disagree. I'm not here to tell you it's wonderful. I'm here to tell you I benefited from the system. But I can understand there's another point of view. Yeshiva University until today is an open college. It's liberal arts. There's no censorship. There's academic freedom. Now, that came to the fore last week, because the very Wednesday that I thought over 1,000 people were at the memorial for the Rav, to me it was a Kiddush Hashem, how many people came out. It was you and Tir, I gather. People didn't come in from Rehovot, but just to see the YU presence here. Tova Lichtenstein or someone from the family told me there were not 1,000 people, 650 people. I guess they went by the seating capacity of Yeshurin. But whether there were 1,000 people or 650 people, here you saw the YU presence in Israel. Now, mind you, these are just Yerushalmiyim. Of those people, they have children here, grandchildren here, great-grandchildren here. There must be tens and tens and tens of thousands of direct descendants of Yeshiva University al Admat HaKodesh. And that very day, Yeshiva University, Kadosa School, that the alumni, whatever, the students, give Jimmy Carter an award. And when you question, how could you do a thing like that? And you saw Richard Joel wrote a whole letter. And the unterste Schur, the bottom line in the letter, was academic freedom. So this is a very interesting question. How far does academic freedom go? And I'm not going to comment further except to say, would you invite Hermann Göring to an affair of Cardoza? Okay? To me, there's not much, there is a difference, but not a great difference. The harm that Carter has caused the state of Israel, you remember his brother, and his brother got millions from an Arab country, and they speak out, and it uses the word apartheid. To me, it is absolutely frightening. Okay, Carter, I hope, is not in favor of killing Jews, but to use the word apartheid, it's frightening. how far is academic freedom? I personally feel academic freedom has to have limits. It's not unlimited. And you can't invite a Sunni Israel. And Dafka, the day that we're coming together to honor the Rub's memory, look what's happening in New York. Okay. Now.
Goran's brother was written up.
Yeah, Goran's brother. That was in the weekend newspapers. Where did I see it? In Yediot. Goran's brother saved, what was it, 36 Jews. They list out the number of Jews that he saved. And this was Hermann Göring's brother. So I have to tell you, like Rakefeta said all along, you cannot teach hatred. You have to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Carter actually, they tell me, was elected and got the power on Jewish money from Atlanta. And he turned so, he has so little understanding. And I tell you, our government officials are at fault too. Every time they open their mouth, they should quote the Bible. Then they can go beyond. But at least quote the Bible. Let Carter know what the Ohev Yisrael and the Scandinavian countries know. I was talking with Morty before class about the lovers of Zion from the Scandinavian countries. I happen to know a little bit about them. I've spoken for them. It all begins with the Bible. If you believe in the Bible, we're not here to. The Arabs, they're welcome. They're here. No one wants to harm them. But this is not their country. The country belongs to the Jewish people. They are guests. Toshav Arai or Toshav Kavua. Ged Sedek, perhaps. But it's not their country. It's our country. God gave it to us. Yes, yes, Ali.
How did Jerry square that away with the Rav not having a Catholic school?
No, I understand. This is a problem. How far, that's what I just said 2 minutes ago, but you weren't there. How far does the limit go of academic freedom? Is it limitless? Imagine you had someone would come to speak who believes in killing anyone who has mental deficiency. Right or wrong? Wasn't that Hitler? Someone will come to speak who believes in killing any homosexual. Okay? Wasn't that Hitler? Where do you draw the line? I think a line has to be drawn. I don't know, but that's a good example. Would you have a woman come into the yeshiva to pose nude in an art class? I think you have to draw a line. Academic freedom is beautiful and lovely, but Torah Tashem Tamima and survival of the Jewish people cancels out any academic freedom, in my humble opinion. But okay, poor Richard Joel. I feel bad for Richard Joel because B.K. Yaakov Leshevet B'Shalva. And no matter what Jacob Avinu did, he already had problems.
Question,
and
you want to pick up where you left off last
year? I'm picking up exactly where.
Because that was with fundraising that he picked Herbie as host.
No, but say that. He announced. I know. I'll come. But now I want to go one step further on this topic, what I didn't say last week. Unlike Yeshiva University, you have today two other institutions that emulate Yeshiva University, but both do not allow for total academic freedom. One of them is Lander College in America, and the other one is right next door, Machon Lev. And Lander College and Machon Lev, both interesting histories. Lander College began, it's modeled after YU, but Rabbi Dr. Bernard Lander always felt that in order to succeed, he needs Haredi support. One of Rabbi Lander's missions, and a mission that he has accomplished successfully, is to reach out to the Haredi world. Those of you that know Flatbush, you look at that big, beautiful building that he built across the street from Flatbush Yeshiva Avenue J. Every day, one day men, one day women, different hours, different days. Who attends there? Endless chassidim. Going to Borough Park. Machon LePanasa. What is Machon LePanasa? It's a different name for Touro. But in Borough Park, you don't want to call it Touro College. So you call it Machon LePanasa. Take a look who goes there. A school for nursing. Who goes there? He has done terrific, terrific accomplishments. And I'm not saying this just because of the new book that came out that takes away a little bit more of Rakefet Olam Haba. But I've said this even before the new book, The Land of Legacy, the new book I'm talking about. I've said it even before. You got to give him credit. He fills a niche that, unfortunately, YU can't fill. If I had my way, I would have all of Baruch Park go to YU. I'd have a whole Hasidish division. And I have my own viewpoint. I'm like the Rav, expose them to the world. They're big enough. They're learned enough. They will survive in dignity as Hasidish Yidden as part of the big world. But the Hasidish Rebbeim don't agree with the Rav. So Landa fills a niche. But any course given in Landa College, the Rebbeim have veto power. It's very interesting. They do have some humanities, they do have some literature, but the teachers are Yoreim v'Shleimim, who are going to teach not the way we heard these courses in YU. And I can already tell you, in my time in YU, without naming the names of the professors, they cursed like sailors. The only place I heard more cursing was in Lubavitch. One time I was at Lubavitch and I tried to push to get close to the Rebbe at a Fabrengen, and this guy with a long beard turns around and did he let me have it with four-letter curse words. Then I found out he was a sailor, a Baal Tshuva. No, he hadn't yet reached the level where he cleaned up his language. But we had professors, those of you who, I don't know, I don't want to mention names. Wow, one of them always cursed Dr. Balkan. I don't know why. It was like the class couldn't begin if he didn't begin with a few good cuss words about Reb Shmuel Balkan. But it was academic freedom. We were exposed. We survived. And I don't know, in life there are a lot of curse words. I see my grandchildren hear movies and they were able to speak a normal language even though they heard some tough words in the movies. So that's Landa College. The other example is Machon Lev. Now, Machon Lev has a fascinating history, which I know very closely, because Machon Lev was established in 68, just a handful of students in a little building in Bayit Vagan. I came in Alaya in 69, and they established BMT in 69. The dean of students and the dean of Machon Lev and BMT was the same individual. He didn't have to create a second name. It was Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Horowitz, Whitey Horowitz. So we knew Machon Lev very well. And I also knew professors of Lev, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. Professor Lev, of course, a refugee who reaches Toronto, grew up under the aegis of Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky in Toronto. And Professor Lev was very close to the, he was not Haredi, but he was close to the Haredi world. When he established Machon Lev, he established it for the very reasons that everyone is yelling today, we have to introduce Tachnit HaLibah into the Haredi world. But in order for Machon Lev to get off the floor, he wanted Rav Shach's approval. And the deal he worked out with Rav Shach was that Machon Lev would not call itself a yeshiva. See, Rav Shach, one of his main, and remember, Rav Shach was invited to teach at YU. Could you imagine, had he gone to Yeshiva Shabbat Chochanan? You can read about it. I saw the papers. I know the story. But without going into any details, that's not important now. But you can read about it in Vic Geller's memoir on the Belkin era. And there you'll get all the details that Rav Shach was invited. Rav Shach's son was my classmate, Effie Shach, Zichrono Levracha, was my classmate in Bernard Revel Graduate School. We sat together in many courses. We got our doctorates a year apart. I got mine 67, Effie got his 68. So I know the Shach family from time immemorial. So Rav Shach said, as long as you don't call it a yeshiva, and it's exactly like YU, they learn half a day, they have Rosh Yeshiva, it's totally modeled on YU, but it's called Beit Sefer Gavoa LeTechnologia. Now, they are more circumscribed than Landa College. There are no humanities in Machon Lev. Machon Lev is purely utilitarian, science, and accountancy and courses. Now they deal with nursing. I understand this for men, for women. Very utilitarian. There is not one course in Machon Lev which has any uppie courses in it whatsoever. So you see, Mechon Lev and Lambda College are very different than YU. And there, Ellie's problem, which was my problem, could never begin. Because in such an institution, you can't do something without permission. The Rosh Yeshiva have to approve. And I don't think, knowing almost all the Rosh Yeshiva in Lambda College, I don't think Reb Eliyahu Soloveitchik and Reb Azi Berzon and Reb Yehuda Panis, Yedidai, would approve inviting Kata and giving him an award. But it's interesting. I'll go one step further on this, but I don't want to do more because these are topics that would take years and years. Yes, Ellie?
Is Mechon Lev not having these courses just a function of like Israeli college?
No. You asked a good question. One second. I want to make it a little louder. One second. You asked a very good question, which I actually was in my mind, but I said if no one asks, I don't want to touch it. But what you're saying is to me that because college begins so much later here, generally begins after the army for a kid who's not from, it's 21, a kid who did Hezda, I shouldn't say a kid who's not from, a kid lower lane, no, I shouldn't talk like that. A kid who did regular army starts at 21. A kid who does Hezda starts like my grandchildren, 23, 24. So there's no time for real liberal arts, but nevertheless, Machon Lev, let's say I have a grandson in the Technion, I have two grandsons in the Technion, both in the medical school. In the medical school, they require a few courses in the humanities so that the young doctor will be broad, you understand? Will not just be, he'll know how to talk with people. Machon Lev would not allow it altogether. And there, you're right, it's partially because of the Israeli system, but mainly to avoid a problem. And if you go to Machon Lev, you'll see they have Chassidische Jungelite, they have a branch in Bnei Brak, they have Litvisha, and the revolution, everything Rakef had said in the press conference, if you follow the Haredi websites, and they own the internet. I think they're more Haredi websites than YU websites. Take my word for it. They own the internet, even though there was a big Asifa and many Yisurim. But they're smarter than the Rebbeim. You know, everyone asks us from today to tomorrow, and they go ahead. The Hashayara Overit, if you know modern Hebrew. The dogs bark, and the people keep on moving forward. And if you read the websites, you start to see that... They understand we need Tachnit Talibah. They understand we need Machon Lev. But it should be done in a Haredi environment, boys and girls separate, etc. Machon Lev is a tremendous success story. And if you want to know the truth, no one should be listening to me, but some of the board of directors, the board of trustees of YU view this kollel. I hope you'll go back and say you gained from it, that it was a nice experience. They view us, why does YU need a kollel here? We're not an Israeli institution. Machon Lev would grab this campus in minutes. You understand? And they would fill it with students. They have thousands and thousands and more and more. And as the Haredi world opens, they're going to be more and more knocking on the door. And it's a tremendous success story. You know about Machon Lev. Some of their graduates are multi-millionaires. SodaStream, computer companies. They're graduates of Machon Lev who sold off for $150 million, okay? So they're a tremendous success story. And it's exactly based upon YU. The new president is a YU product. Some of the past presidents have been YU products. And Chaim Sekonik, Professor Sekonik, the new president, they tell me a YU graduate a little after my time. I heard the name. But my wife told me that her mother always spoke about a Skokonic family from Brooklyn. It must be the same family from going back generations. And it's a tremendous... But there, you can't... It's not YU. It's not unlimited. It's not open. It's not that the professor can do as he wishes and you can go and cry to the Rav and the Rav will tell you what, you don't want to be prepared for the big world? In the big world you're going to meet hundreds of thousands of people like this professor. Learn how to deal with it. Don't be a baby. Yeah.
Just one thing. As soon as you decide that you're going to want to do more, teach more subjects or open graduate schools, you're not going to have a choice to have the academic freedom. And I mean, in Turo's case, they put their graduate schools very far away, but these things go on at their graduate schools. They have a law school and a medical school that...
Yeah, no, I understand. In America, you can't control it because there's government regulations, because you're taking money, and when they came out against YU, that YU has a Loa Leinu, a homosexual club, it turned out Landa had the same thing, or Turo had the same thing. I'm well aware of it. But nevertheless, in Israel, no one will interfere with Machon Lev. Here already, it's a Haredi world. The Haredim are taking over the country. The Haredim are taking over the world. That the Haredim will not remain the same narrow Haredim goes without saying. It's a beautiful process at work. And we have tremendous responsibility. That's what I'm going to talk about in Herzliya, on Yom Yerushalayim. We have tremendous responsibility to show that one can be a Gaon, a Tzaddik, and a Chassid, and can be part of the big world. Gevetoshev and Achim Machon. Okay, but now let me go further. There's a lot. It's what we touched upon now. Again, it leads to the whole question: what was Rav Shimshon of Ferl Hirsch's approach? And the answer, I think, is very. We have to be honest. I have to give Jacob Breuer credit that he washed my face in mud in 50 plus years ago. But he was big enough to become a good friend of mine and appreciate my teachings. But it doesn't mean he was wrong, and I think he was right. If Reb Hirsch came to life today, he would be very unhappy with Yeshiva University, happy with Landa College, and ecstatic with Machon Lev. And I challenge anyone, and there's some bright people sitting in front of me, I challenge anyone to prove me wrong. And I repeat, if Reb Hirsch came to life today, he would be unhappy with Yeshiva University, he would be quite happy with Landa College, and he would be ecstatic with Machon Lev. Sam, put that into your pipe and think about it.
Excuse me? You wouldn't want them to learn more humanities?
Could be with Machon Lev. He'd give some lectures on literature, on poetry. Could be a little bit more humanities. I'll agree, but controlled. Follow me, Sam? Okay. It's fascinating. What do you think about it? Okay. Now, I want to pick up. So that, I added to last week's lecture. And I added it because I couldn't believe that the question of academic freedom comes up tonight, that 1,000 YU people are meeting in Jerusalem, and in New York they're honoring Cardozo. Wow. Now, the campaign is announced. And as Rabbi Rubin rightfully recalls, Herbert S. Goldstein is given the honor, and Enoch Inami, your PhD, is important. When you're Harry Fischel's son-in-law, it certainly adds to your ability to function and to get up and say, announcing a $5 million campaign. Now, you have to understand, this sent shockwaves throughout the American Jewish community. And we have to be honest, unlike Art Scroll, who will tell you Torah began in America post-World War II, it's absolutely not so. Torah began in America with the establishment of Eitz Chaim in 1886. From that point on, there's a gradual development. Yeshiva Shabbos Kol Chanan, the Gedolei Yisrael. And you gotta understand some of these greenhorns who didn't speak a perfect English. Their English was accented. They were more at home in Yiddish. Some of these individuals became multi-millionaires. And there now was an Orthodox world in America that had integrated on the American scene. And people couldn't believe it. A $5 million campaign. Now, the seminary was not the seminary yet. You have to understand, and I can't redo my lectures of years ago, But the seminary began as an Orthodox institution. Nobody but nobody denies that until today. You read their charter. You can read Herbert Parsons' history. Read Moshe Davis's doctorate. The reason they didn't use the word Orthodox, and in consonance with tradition, the reason they didn't use the word Orthodox was very simple reason. Not to scare away non-Orthodox money. You begin a seminary, you need money. You need money, who are you going to appeal to? The East European Jews in 1887 were a bunch of schnorrers, basically. And even where they were in schnorrers, they could not appreciate a seminary graduate. And I quote it to you, I don't have to requote, but the Taugeblatt. This is a rabbi. He learned Masechet Megillah, took him a year. Back in Europe, we learned Masechet Megillah in 2 weeks. Baba Batra took a year. Not Megillah. Right or wrong? You've all learned. I'm talking to Lamdunum here. You can learn Megillah in a week. What's the big deal? Megillah, time it. It's all right. Brachot is a little bigger, so you have to spend more time. They laughed at the seminary. So the seminary is being organized. It has to appeal to German money. A good deal of the German money is reformed. Even someone like Jacob Schiff, who grew up on the lap of Reb Shimshon Fol Hirsch, and as Satma calls him today, Reb Yankel Schiff, even Reb Yankel Schiff, you understand, you got to appeal to him. You can't appeal to the East Side Schnorrers. He may be the president of Temple Emanuel, but at least he will have a feeling for JTS. Of course, JTS practically falls apart. There's no money. There's no clientele to support it. The Reformed Jews want Reform rabbis, and the East Europeans, who are now hundreds and hundreds of thousands, willen a chemische Rav, was red Yiddish, was versteht Yiddish, was kann sagen a gute Shia, was kann paskin in a Shaila. Why do they need someone from the seminary? So by 1902, the seminary is ready to fall apart, and a number of very important Reformed Jews, including Reb Yankel Schiff, with all due respects to Landau, get involved and put money in, and they bring Solomon Schechter to America. Now, Solomon Schechter was orthoprax. He was not totally orthodox. If you read his writings, you'll see already he subscribed to the concept of historic Judaism, the historical process, gradual development, Torah Shebaal Peh, and he was a mixture. Hasidic background, Shneur Zalman, Chabad, I believe his father was a Sheikhet. He wasn't a Gadol Hador in learning, but he knew how to learn, and he had scientific approach, and the Cairo Geniza, and all that went with it. He attracted a faculty that was basically orthodox. You had Drachman, you had Marias, Pereira Mendes. At first, these people were all with the seminary. You had Hymanson from England, big Talmud Chacham, all with the seminary. Louis Ginsberg. Now, Louis Ginsberg, again, you see, with Louis Ginsberg, the greatest Rosh Yeshiva stood in awe of him. Because Louis Ginsberg was an Ilui Atzum, one of the great Iluim from the Europäische Yeshiva. Louis Ginsberg became Louis Ginsberg, and some of his writings, particularly when it came to the Bible, he accepted all the biblical criticism. Later in life, his son writes in his biography of his father that later in life he regretted having accepted all the biblical criticism, and he moved to a much more orthodox theological position. But I have to tell you, I've gone through his tshuva. My student David Golinkin, are you familiar, put out a volume, The Responsa of Louis Ginsberg, published by the seminary, I believe, Shulchan, whatever. David Golinkin, you recognize the name? Rabbi Golinkin is the the chancellor, whatever they call him, the dean of the seminary presence here, he's fought some bitter battles which he's lost. I don't want to go into detail with the homosexuals, etc. His father was a conservative rabbi. His grandfather was a Europäischer Rav, a member of the Beit Din of Greater Boston. And David himself is personally totally observant. So David put out the tshuvah, and it was given to me a gift in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I went through the entire sefer. I did not find one tshuvah lahalacha that I would disagree with. I did not find one. And this is Louis Ginsberg. So you see, some are in English, some are in Hebrew. It's like the Rav answered in it's like the Rambam. Some things he wrote in Aramaic, some things he wrote in Arabic, some things he wrote in Rabbinic Hebrew.
It's available every year, the Jewish book,
at the book fair, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's not a bestseller. How many people know Louis Ginsberg, and how many people know, response literature? But it's a fascinating volume. These Balabatim that were supporting the seminary, and many of them were Reform, but they felt there has to be a more traditional presence in America. Jacob Schiff is a prime example. Felix Warburg. Louis Marshall. Cyrus Adler, who himself was a Shomer Shabbos and succeeded Schechter as the head of the seminary. These Balabatim were shaking. $5 million? Where are we going to get it? Where are they going to get it? How can we support JTS? It's going to take away money. And they're going to want money from us too. And you got to remember, to the Reformed mind, what's the difference between JTS circa 1920s and Yeshiva? What do you give you a better example? In the mid-60s, the United Synagogue Council, which was very powerful at that time, no one ever dreamt the day would come that it would disappear. The Synagogue Council sponsored a dinner where they honored the three heads of American Jewry. Nelson Gluck, Rebel's nephew. Louis Finkelstein, Professor Finkelstein, and Rav Shmuel Belkin. Tell me, who looked more Jewish? Professor Finkelstein or Rabbi Belkin? Just think what I'm saying. Louis Finkelstein, the son of Reb Shimon Finkelstein, that is Tatis Gevan Allah Yudapaya Shadab, was a Rev in Brooklyn. Gentlemen, who looked more Jewish? Ellie, I'm asking a serious question. I've known people at the cult will meet me the first time. They look at me. That cannot be Harav Rakefet. Impossible. I've heard that. I've heard it my own ears. Now it's not so prevalent because my pictures appear in back of my books. But I remember kids meeting me the first time. This is Rav Rakefet. Kid! It's a culture shock. Dr. Belkin had a little Van Dyke this big. Professor Finkelstein, who told the class, Rabbi Rubin, had a regular beard. Full beard. That Doiska Kukvach Siddishiyid. Belkin wore a yarmulke. He wore a yarmulke. Cut it out. The yarmulke. Their yarmulkes were the same size. Don't play games with the yarmulkes. We all wore the black yarmulkes. What kind of yarmulke did I wear in America? A kid looks at my yarmulke on a picture and says, oh, you were not good this. What are you, an idiot? This was the only yarmulke everyone wore. They're anachronistic. They judge by the standards of 2014. Okay, Baruch Hashem. So a balabas who looks at who heads up YU and who heads up the seminary, it was very difficult to understand the nuances of difference. And when they heard $5 million, let's spare money. This is Klal Yisrael. It's 1925, it's 1926, 1927. Let's merge. One budget, one school. We'll build the campus. But we'll have one faculty. And I want to tell you, and all of you know that not only did I do research for my doctorate, I did even more research postdoctoral. I'm not here to repeat what's published. You can look at Bernard Revel. You can look at Rakafat Aaron. You can see all that I published. I'm not interested in that now, of course. You can read it. It's no sense to bore you with what went back and forth and the negotiations. But I am convinced they could have worked out a very beautiful merger. YU is a Litvishi yeshiva. I use the word YU. It's contemporary terms. I should really say yeshiva and yeshiva college. Yeshiva Sbeth Chochanan. It was a Litvishi yeshiva with Litvishi learning. All the Rashi yeshiva, the Maitshita was a Litvisha. Rav Shimon Shkop was a Litvisha. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was a Litvisha. I told you there was one Rebbe in the yeshiva, an Ungarishi. I don't want to tell you what they called him behind his back. What Rav Shmuel Gerstenfeld suffered, don't ask. Don't ask. I can't repeat it. Better you shouldn't, though. And by the way, he was the only one in the whole yeshiva who knew how to paskin a shayla. When it came, no, it's a fact. When it came to establish a beis din, the yeshiva had a beis din before the RCA. Rav Shmuel Gerstenfeld was the beis din. He knew how to do chlitz, he knew how to write again. He's the only one who knew how to do it. He was there. No, I'm telling you the facts. Nebuch, his son, became the Reform Rabbi of Washington. And at his levaya, they wouldn't let the son speak. It was in the yeshiva, they wouldn't let the son speak. It was a big, did you know him? Did you know the son? You know, that was his son. Nebuch, what America did to us. What America did to us. Bernard Leventhal, his son Louis Pseida, Israel Leventhal. Okay. So how would they deal with the seminary? The seminary was modeled upon Hildesheimer, modeled upon Breslau, modeled upon Vienna. It was Solomon Schechter's baby. Scientific Jewish scholarship. There would have been a very easy solution. The college kids study Gemara in accordance with Lithuanian tradition. They study for smicha with Lithuanian tradition. You run a graduate school for those who are interested, they'll go into Chochmat Yisrael. And Dafka, to go into Chochmat Yisrael, the seminary today produces nothing. Why? Because the average kid who comes to the seminary can't read two lines of Gemara properly today. I've heard stories from people who teach there. It's beyond words. It's a different world today. The seminary in the 10s, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, 50 to 60% of their students were yeshivas from Chochanim graduates. In my time, I taught children of classmates of mine or those who were there a year before me, a year after me, all became conservative rabbis. Everyone went to the seminary. Seminary was the future. It's not like today. Today, I don't know. I know kids who came from the seminary to YU. I taught here in the Kollel already. A few kids who had smicha from JTS or their branch on the coast, the Jewish University, whatever it's called, and they came to read Spalei Tshuva, wanted to start learning on a level. But in the 20s, you could have had kids who knew Shas and Paiskim, could have gone on to fabulous research in Chochmat Yisrael, could have gone on, created a whole world of scientific scholarship on the highest level. And I believe they could have solved the problem. I mean, you got to remember, Rabbi Revel had the first doctorate issued at Dropsy. Rabbi Rebbe was not opposed to Chochmat Yisrael. Reb Moshe had not yet come to the yeshiva. Reb Moshe had problems with Chochmat Yisrael. No two ways about it. He left Europe because he had a big fight with Professor Balaban, that Tachkamoni, and Mayor Lichtenstein told it the other night, Balaban fired him. I don't know if Balaban fired him, but there certainly was a big fight between them, and he was very unhappy at Tachkamoni. But Reb Moshe was not yet in America. The Maitshita, he was not opposed to Chochmat Yisrael. The Maitshita was a genius, was very open, was a different type of individual altogether. I told you that when Reb Lazy Yehuda Finkel, the Mir Rosh Yeshiva's old chaver, visited America to raise funds for Mir. So Reb Lazy Yehuda said to the Maitshita, it's the mid-20s, maybe 26, he said to the Maitshita, No, Shleimala. If you would have remained in Europe, you would have been the biggest Rosh Yeshiva today in all of Eastern Europe. That's where it was at then, remember. And the Major to study is I get it, you're absolutely right. But if I remained in Europe, I still would have to have 1 foot there and 1 foot in America. So Reb Lacy, that's a Mishlein, Reb Osmenkman, what do you mean? So the Major to answer, because by Hashkafis, you wouldn't tolerate me in Europe. I'd have to have 1 foot there and 1 foot in America. And I honestly believe, this is from all my research and knowing the players, these problems could have been solved. But the one problem that was insurmountable was Mordechai Kaplan. And Mordechai Kaplan, no matter which way you turned, there was no way you could find a solution to Mordechai Kaplan. Now, we're going to go into his classroom in a minute. I'm going to show you an amazing source. As Rav Volk used to say, it was worth traveling from Rehovot just to learn about this source. But let me say a few words about teachers. You occasionally have teachers who, because of their personality, their teaching ability, become dominant figures. No one appointed them. I'll give you a simple example. When Reb Moshe Soloveitchik died, many of the students in Yeshiva and Yeshiva College were opposed to the Rav taking his place. You all know how much has been written, how much has been said about this, how much a guy named Rakefet has lectured on this. Well, there was opposition. Who's the Rav? Who is that guy from Boston? They called the Rav in Yeshiva when he started teaching, they called him JB, his initials. Oh, what, when, where? Ah, but the Rav came in on a one-year contract. Remember, Herbert Goldstein worked it out. Once again, he had influence because he had the PhD. One-year contract. And he started lecturing. And slowly but surely, who named him the Rav? 44. The students named him the Rav. Do you know the story? I told you the story. If you don't know the story, you have to know it. It's very simple. By 44, Rebbe was starting to be Rebbe. And he desperately wanted to be president of the yeshiva. According to Shalamet Meiselman's memoir, his sister's memoir, the fact that they opposed him was the determining factor that suddenly aggravated Reb Moshe so that he died. Read the memoir. You don't have to believe. Don't have to believe me. Read the memoir. Ephraim, read the memoir. Soloveitchik Heritage, Shulamit Meiselman, Ktav. Okay. When Dr. Belkin was elected president in Rosh Yeshiva, the students said about the Rav behind his back, Rebbe lost out the election, Dr. Belkin is the Rosh Yeshiva, we're going to call him the Rav, a unique title. And that's how the Rav got the title. And Rebbe didn't like the title. Rebbe said many years later, Ach Vashteinist, everyone calls me the Rav. But he had to live with it. I have in my book, people call me the Rav. People call me the Rav. I quote him. I quote Rebbe. And why wasn't he happy with the title? He said, Reb Moshe is the Rav. I'm the Rosh Yeshiva. He said, what's a Rav's tafkid b'chayim? What's his calling, his job, his responsibility? The Paskin Shilas. Reb Moshe, Paskin Shilas. I give Shayurim, I'm the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Moshe is the Rav. But you can't change popular language. Language ain't in the dictionary, but ain't certainly is on the streets. So the Rav became the Rav. No one appointed him. As far as YU is concerned, until today when you refer to Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, he was a member of the Ritz faculty, was a Rosh Yeshiva, no different than a Rosh Yeshiva named Arnold Rothkopf. Rothkopf was also a Rosh Yeshiva. No different. We all sat at a meeting together. Rosh Yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva. You know my button. Why you everyone's called Rosh Yeshiva? Otherwise they'd kill each other fighting for the title. So everyone is called Rosh Yeshiva. But Dr. Belkin was the Rosh Yeshiva. But the Rav, by virtue of his personality, became the Rav. You cannot envision why you without the Rav. 44 years of teaching, the dominant person. The buck ended at the Rav. When he opened his mouth, that was it. Halacha l'maisa, he was the man. Now that happens in institutions. La havdil between Mori Urebi and Mordechai Kaplan. Mordechai Kaplan was such an individual at the seminary. He taught Medrash, taught in the Teachers Institute of the seminary, taught in Hebrew, evolved a whole new philosophy. The students loved him. I had spoke with students at Mordechai Kaplan, and boy, were they off the path, Mechalalei Shabbos rabbis who drove to shul on Shabbos. I can tell you in Livingston, in Essex County, in South Orange, top Talmidim, Mechalalei Shabbos. They worshipped the ground that he walked on. He was charismatic. Later, the Depression comes along. Mordechai Kaplan's message was fabulous. It fell like rain on a parched forest. Why? Can anyone tell me why? Because during the Depression, who could believe in God? It was a terrible period. People were suffering. You all know, professors were selling apples on the streets. My parents bore the scars of depression all the days of their life. And I'm telling you as it is, my father was a postman. He never would leave the post office. He was offered chances to go into business, friends, make money, max money. He said, from the post office, I know I get a salary every week. He remembered the depression. My mother never trusted a bank. She remembered standing in line to take out. I think, what did they limit you to? $10? I don't know. One withdrawal? Run on the banks? You know, read about it. My mother always used to put money in this bank, that bank, divide it up, 5 different banks, 6 different. Who do you need? Somebody else. Oh, God forbid there can be another depression. They'll limit you taking out money. She remembered yet what happened in the 30s. And Mordechai Kaplan comes along. Judaism as a civilization. There may or not be a God. God is not the focal point of Mordechai Kaplan's theology. Right or wrong. Judaism is a civilization. A civilization lives on with or without God. You don't need a God. You have to believe in God. Mordechai Kaplan. They loved him. This is fabulous. We don't have to have belief, but we have to be Jewish. We have to continue. It's a civilization. And you all know the stories I've told you with Mordechai Kaplan. He used to wear handkerchiefs around his neck. They would ask him, Professor Kaplan, why you would have two handkerchiefs tied together? My father went that way. It's part of the civilization. I told you to start with the umbrella. One time it was pouring rain, he's walking with an umbrella, and they say, Professor Kaplan, here you're wearing handkerchiefs. How come you're carrying an umbrella on Shabbos? He says, for civilization, you don't get sick. Now, whether it really happened, I don't know if it's an anecdote, but as the Rebbe used to say, anecdotes, Daniel, reflect what the people think. You follow me, Yoni? It's an interesting anecdote. That's Mordechai Kaplan. That is Mordechai Kaplan. I gave him a lift in my car. I told you. The man was in his 90s. And he shows me, he thinks I don't know his philosophy. You know, I told him I'm a graduate of YU. I teach at YU. I teach in BMT. BMT was a very chashuva institution then. We changed Torah history, as you know. And I played a major role. I don't deny it. Beit Medrash LaTorah. Because Whitey Hurwitz had grown up in Chicago and grew up actually in Wisconsin. His father was a shochet, a chassidish yid, a chassid. But he went to Skokie. Skokie was called Beit Medrash LaTorah. That's one of its names. You follow? Hebrew Theological College, Beit Medrash LaTorah. So he named, BMT actually was named Jerusalem Torah College. But he called it Beit Medrash LaTorah, BMT Quran. The abbreviation BMT, because it's a subway in New York. JTC hat nicht geklinkt, but BMT, a subway in New York, BMT, that caught on. And he showed me his fringes. He wears fringes. It's a civilization. This is the way Jews have to go. By the way, there are members of his family who are from Jews, you should know. I don't know direct descendants, but I've met nieces and nephews of his who are from Jews. I can't get over it. Now, Mordechai Kaplan was extremely powerful. What a lecturer. What charisma. What a message. Now let's go into his classroom and let's see why. How did he captivate? How do we come to his classroom? Professor Israel Schleffer. Let me spell the name. Schleffer. S-C-H-E-F-F-L-E-R. Born 1923. To the best of my knowledge, I hope he's alive. Those of you that are computer geniuses or computer-wise, check it out. They tell me there's a website of people to check that they're still alive. But according to the Wikipedia, he is alive. Israel Schleffer is a typical example of the 1900s. His father, an immigrant from Jew, Chassidish background, didn't let America change him, but became much more broad in America. And his father, who was not the most learned of Jews, you'll see in a minute what his business was, it's an interesting description. His father gave a toshav anochim machem. You have to broaden. And this little Israel went to RJJ, went to Talmudical Academy. We both graduated the same high school. Then he went to Brooklyn College and the seminary. And he winds up getting an MHL and a DHL honorary doctorate from JTS. Gets a doctorate at the U of P, goes on to teach at Harvard, where he teaches for 40 years till the day he retires in 1992. His greatness was in philosophy, interpreting language, interpreting symbolism, education, 40 years till the day he retired, a world famous professor at Harvard. His son, by the way, is professor of philosophy and law at NYU today, Samuel Schleffler. Now, he wrote a memoir, and this is what I'm going to quote from, Teachers of My Youth, published 1995. In other words, once he retired, this is an obscure academic publication. I have to thank my student, Dr. Phil Kaslow, Shragai Kaslow, who got this booklet for me, or book, I should say. It's a soft-covered book. Probably, again, I don't know how many people bought it, but it was a very fascinating volume. And describes the influences upon him. And he describes how he graduated from MTA, and once he graduates from Talmudical Academy, there was no Manhattan branch, and he wants to go to a good college which has more courses than Yeshiva College. His father wants him to have a broader education, so he decides to go to Brooklyn, but his father wants him to continue his Talmudic studies, and the only way he can combine Brooklyn College would be to go to JTS, like many people today go to Columbia and go to JTS. And he describes his father raised in Hasidic culture, but listen to this. Having arrived in America penniless in 1909, he refused ever again to speak Romanian, even to my mother, in the confines of the household. Romania, oppressive, intolerant, and thoroughly anti-Semitic. Now you just think about that. How many people survived World War II? Some of them never, ever wanted to speak Polish again, Hungarian again, or German again. And you notice this line, even to my mother. You know, your wife, you courted her in a certain language. You said, I love you in a certain language. You proposed to her in a certain language. I cannot conceive of speaking Yiddish to my wife, except when we're joking around, or speaking Hebrew to my wife. I speak English. Imagine never to use your native language again. It's fascinating. Look at the Americans in Israel. You hear complaint after complaint in Beit Shemesh, which is a classic example. The kids go to school, graduate high school, and they cannot read Hebrew. They cannot think in Hebrew. Their homes are English-speaking. Their friends are English-speaking. Bnei Akiva is English-speaking. Everything they do is English-speaking. And it's growing up in Israel. They can be born here. And Hebrew is a second language. And I was once told off because in our parking lot to my building, we have a minyan Matzoi Shabbos and Yom Tov. And a German man who lived well into his 90s, ran away from Hitler, got here in the late 30s, family totally integrated on the religious Zionist community, famous family. And he once told us off that we're speaking English, you know, because there are a lot of Anglos in my building and in my neighborhood. And I got a little upset with him. I'm speaking English with people I know from time immemorial. It's natural for me to speak English, for us to speak English to each other. But I told him, Yesh hevdel echad beinenu. Ata beirachto megamani lahatzil et nafshecha, v'ani anchnu alinu arza meiratzon. Me'eretz mefutachat, v'al rama yoter gavoha, mima shepagashnu kan b'medinat Yisrael. So you see, you got to give credit. His father refused, and he loved America. Now, what did his father do to struggle out a living? His father was a salesman. Listen to this paragraph. You see, memoir literature is so important. As I write in my introduction to Washington, what led me to do Washington because of the doctorate at Hebrew U, Stamfer's doctorate, Shaul Stamfer, Professor Shaul Stamfer, a brilliant doctorate on Volozhin. And what was that doctorate based upon? Memoir literature. Where do we have memoir literature? On Yeshiva University, on what life was like, what it was like in the classroom, what Bnei Akiva was like, growing up was like, coming on Aliyah. And this is so important, because memoir literature essentially paints a real picture, particularly if it's someone who knows scholarship writing it and he's not going to put in concepts that are not correct. Listen to this paragraph. He writes about his father. I remember accompanying him when I was about 10 years old on a sales trip to open new territory on Long Island. He had a car and represented a company selling crockery and glassware. Entering a new store with his case full of samples, he would locate the manager and begin his sales pitch in Yiddish. I would cringe with embarrassment and later ask him to explain, how do you know that the manager understands Yiddish, I'd say. And he would reply as if the point were totally obvious. Quote, why, I don't know, of course, and that's exactly why I start with Yiddish. If he understands, he will reply. If not, I have time at that point to switch to English. End quote. Now, just think about that. It's a fabulous description. It shows you America, it shows you his father, it shows you the salesman in his father, and it shows you, number one, the father was more at home in Yiddish than in English, but it shows you that all over when you came to stores that were selling, the chances were that the owner of the store or the manager of the store would be a Yiddish speaker. Very, very fascinating. Now, here is this young man, Israel Schleffer, who has a very narrow background, growing up in Brooklyn, growing up in a home that's Shomer Shabbos, going to RJJ and then to Talmudical Academy, And suddenly he comes into the classroom with Mordechai Kaplan. In this dreamlock complacency of mind that was shadowed with my experience at the seminary, and in particular by my encounter with Professor Mordechai Kaplan. I knew nothing about Professor Kaplan prior to enrolling in the college, and had no inkling of his new philosophy of Reconstructionism, of his influential books, of his establishment of the Society for the Advancement of Judaism, of his radical versions of Jewish religion and peoplehood, which had made him a dangerous heretic in the eyes of the Orthodox. All I knew was that I was signed up to take a course with him in Jewish history, or some allied subject, as near as I can remember. It was a rather large class. Professor Kaplan, a man of medium height, with roundish face and short beard, took his place at the desk in front of the room. He spoke slowly and deliberately in a Hebrew with a trace of American accent, gesturing eloquently with his right hand as he lectured. His manner was serious. It struck me as even somewhat sour. Perhaps his furrowed brow and impersonal air were just signs of concentration or abstractedness. At any rate, he seemed to be looking through us rather than at us, betraying no hint of warmth or personal connection. I don't remember what he talked about that day, but I do remember his assigning us portions of George Foote Moore's classic work, Judaism, to read. Remember, this is a Gentile. In any case, the theme he picked up on was the development of monotheism out of early beliefs in polytheism and henotheism, traces of which were discernible in the biblical text. This was indeed a shock. The Bible was to be viewed developmentally rather than as a timeless book. Moreover, traces of beliefs repugnant to us were to be located within it and identified as such without apology. The development in question was to be discerned by looking at the text from without, as if it were that by applying independent criteria of historical and scientific method, using the tools of philology, anthropology, archaeology, comparative religions, and so forth. Allegorical interpretations in the service of apologetic readings were altogether excluded. Did you understand that sentence? Medrashim, Chazal, Agada. Apologetics meant inevitable distortion of the truth as estimated in light of the best available modern resources. At such, apologetical impulses were in conflict with intellectual honesty and have to give way. Dr. Kaplan was not subtle about this. He did not enter into refined argumentation on an epistemological plane. He simply and bluntly contrasted what he called the modern universe of discourse with the pre-modern universe of discourse and showed us how traditional beliefs could no longer be credited within the modern framework of knowledge and inquiry. And he goes on, and he describes that first lecture. Reminds me of Washington, where I described the first lecture I heard in Yeshiva College from Professor Louis Feldman, and how that lecture cemented me to Yeshiva University. Here it is exactly the opposite. And he goes on, I can quote more. He shows contradictions from Bereshit to our scientific knowledge today of the way the world was created, and Israel Schleffer's world is shattered, destroyed, challenged. He goes on, as you can understand, ultimately to become a very fine conservative Jew, breaking with his youth, with the traditions of his youth, with his parents, a fine conservative Jew professor at Harvard. Kaplan, what a lecturer. What a teacher. How dynamic. How dramatic. No allegories. No apologies. Tell me, Ellie, if you were in Kaplan's class and you could talk back to him, what would you say to him? Look what he just said to you. What would you say to him? You know what I would say to him? Professor Kaplan, I want to ask you a simple question. Why doesn't the Torah talk about computers? Why doesn't the Torah talk about automobiles? Why doesn't the Torah talk about airplanes? Why doesn't the Torah talk about the dateline? Why doesn't the Torah talk about artificial insemination? AID, AIH. I told you, a comrade of mine just brought up my shurim of many, many years ago, an artificial insemination donor. I was blown away by how beautifully he wrote it up, and I was blown away by how much that Rebbe knows. Wow.
Wait, so where is this written up?
It hasn't been published yet. He wants to do more, and then he's going to publish a book. Gave him my bracha.
I would have
told Sam, what, 1 second, let me tell what I would tell. Then you can say, Sam Frumson, you know how many compliments I've gotten because of what Rabbi Frumson did with my article on, you have no idea. He turned me into a hero. Who listens to 6 tapes, 9 hours, but an article you can read, 9 minutes, everyone is jumping, and you did a beautiful job. It's taco what I said. All right, I edited it. I looked at it. I admit I made a change or two. But Baruch Hashem, Professor Kaplan, Torah is given at a certain time, in a certain context. Divra Torah b'lashon b'nei adam. Could you picture the Torah being given and talking about concepts that no one would understand what you're talking about? And you have a problem with anthropology, with beliefs, with this, with kavanot. Open up the Rambam or Nevuchim. Please, the Rambam had your same problems and he dealt with it beautifully. Torah is given within a certain context. You can't change Maisa Bereishis. You can't tell humans living at a certain time not to be humans. The greatest example of Baruch Hashem, we all have one wife in this classroom. As far as I know in Chazal, everyone has one wife. And yet, when the Torah is given, people had 2 wives. People had concubines. So you can't give Torah in the year 2000 before the common era, 3000 before the common era, and talk about what's going to be 3000 beyond the common era. Torah is eternal. And there's a system, there's a method that makes Torah eternal. But this point of view, a medrash, so you don't want to take it literally. So, look into the writings of Reb Tzvi Hirschayot. Look into the writings of Reb Avram ben Arambam. Look into the Maral. Look how many lessons, how many ethics, how many morals, how much insight one can get from Midrashim. But this kid comes in, he's blown away. Blown away, he's shattered. And you see, this Kaplan, the way he speaks, and you'll see, I can give you examples if you look at the book, if you can get hold of it. It's amazing. He brings examples. What an idiot. The Torah is giving you a scientific document of how the world is created. We still don't know how the world was created scientifically, to put it black and white into every type of formula. Lo nitna Torah, lo malchei asharit, and divrei Torah b'lashon b'nei adam. That's exactly what it means. But you see, this Kaplanism, this is adaptive Judaism. This goes on and on and on. And what's lacking here, and this, you cannot stress enough. I told you, I have Gafni Winiaz on tape where he mocks Sefer Vayikra. Tova, the daughter of Divi Hartman, quotes her father as he can't understand why Sefer Vayikra was put into the Chumash. Like it's degrading. You know why everyone heard this from the Rebbe? And I'm elaborating. I have the Rav too, talks about it, the famous talk he gave in 79 on the Haftorah. Why does everyone, on the Haftorah, let me say it clearly. Why does everyone, why such enmity to Sefer Vayikra? Because Sefer Vayikra begins, first of all, Karbonot. What does Karbon mean? Adam ki yakriv Karbon. So the Balei Musa used to say, Mendaf sign a mensch in order to bring a Karbon. You know what it means? Adam ki yakriv Karbon. You bow before God. It's an expression that I am only a little human being. I bow before the Creator. This is critical to understanding Yiddishkeit. If you don't bow before the Ribbono Shel Olam, then of course everything can be misexplained, re-explained, pushed aside. You're bigger, you have science, you have knowledge, you think you have it all. Yeah, in the year 2013, you know what's been done until now. Who knows what will be in the year 4013. The Rav said a Meira Dikvot, which I never forgot. A Jew, Yaakov Avinu, has a dream. Hasulam Mutzav Atza. V'rosho Magia Hashemayma. He bows to the Almighty. He's at the foot of the ladder. The ladder goes up to heaven. Paro has a dream. Paro has a god. V'hine Paro Omeid al Hayar. He stands on top of the Nilus. He stands on top of the Nile. He's bigger than his God. He bosses his God around. He owns his God. He looks down at his God. This is Mordechai Kaplan. This is adaptive Judaism. The inability to surrender. What is Yiddishkeit? And this is what we spoke about time and again, time and again. When you hear the Hafkat Kedusha. Hafkat Kedusha. Homosexuality. Normative. Excuse me? Of course. Vayikra, this week said Arayat. Open marriage today. Well, what the words that we're confronted with. Lotasu Kamas Eretz Mitzrayim, this week's Pasha. What does the Torah Kanim say? Men married men, women married women. God have mercy. And the modern mind, and in our camp as well. That inability to bow. The Rav taught us. Famous talk on Pashat Korach. Also, so crucial. Pashat Korach. You have to put away your mind and bow to the Torah mind. At times it's a conflict because we live in a certain culture. Today I absolutely agree with you that the modern world, the New York Times world, the world that my student from Chavurei Torah wrote that letter, homosexuality, normative. Normative, it's the end of the world. The end of the Jewish people, the end of reproduction, the end of family life. A judge down south in a case that came before him about 2 years ago, I give that judge all the credit in the world. He said a husband and wife are like a key that goes into the lock. He says two men or two women are not a key in a lock. And he threw the case out. Kol hakavod, but I would have said it a little bit differently. That the New York Times can't tell us how to think halakhically, how to think Jewishly. And this is the tremendous conflict. Sefer Vayikra, Tuma Vatara. Tuma Vatara is such an alien thought to the modern mind. Everything goes. To our mindset, there's Tuma, there's Tara. We have to be careful. We have to know the boundaries. A person has to walk very agilely, very adeptly between Ger V'toshav Anochi Imachem. And this pure Shlefa was torn away by Mordechai Kaplan. And he goes on how Kaplan takes Sefer Bereshit The astronomical beliefs represented in Genesis, for example, are totally at odds with contemporary understandings. That heaven is a firmament dividing the water beneath it from those above it is stated explicitly in Genesis. The general notion of heaven as an inverted bowl sitting on the earth with holes through which the upper waters might fall as rain seems to be the implicit view. The idea that sun and moon are lights fixed in the firmament in order to provide a division between day and night and order the seasons is plainly given in Genesis. No amount of allegorizing will remedy such conceptions without the supposition that the ancients themselves did not take literally, which is wholly implausible on historical grounds. The evident fact is that the Bible's cosmology differs from our own, and we must acknowledge it to contain views we consider literally false. It's beyond words. Lo nitna Torah l'malachei sheres. Dibra Torah b'lashon b'nei adam. The Torah was given at a certain period, at a certain time, with a certain amount of knowledge around it. How this intelligent young man could fall for Mordechai Kaplan, and I blame Talmudical Academy that they not give him the kalim, the ability, the learning, the knowledge, the understanding, the theological stance, that he could have gone on into Mordechai Kaplan's class and taken it and hit Professor Kaplan head on. What's interesting with Mordechai Kaplan is, with World War II, there was a bit of tshuva began in America. And people in the depth of despair started to ask questions. And at that point, I believe it was 45, Mordechai Kaplan published the Reconstructionist Siddur. And that Siddur eliminated so much of Torah and tradition that, I'm not talking now about what the Agudat HaRabbanim did. I believe it was at the Biltmore Hotel. They held a conference in public. All the newspapers were there. Put Mordechai Kaplan into Cheirim and threw his Siddur into the fire, turned it into ashes, made the front page, if I'm not mistaken, or the middle page, but it could have very well been the front page of the daily news the next day, Mordechai Kaplan's Siddur being burned. But not just that, from his own colleagues at the seminary, three of the distinguished faculty members published an advertisement differing and distancing themselves from Mordechai Kaplan's Siddur. So it's amazing, if I recall correctly, I spoke about it, I actually showed the Cheirim in class when I dealt with Mordechai Kaplan and the conservative movement. Alexander Marx was one, Saul Lieberman was two, the third may have been Finkelstein himself. It has to be checked. Go to a website. I don't recall if Louis Ginsberg, could be it was Louis Ginsberg, but you can Google it and let me know what you come up with. At the time that I lectured on it, I had the exact names, it's well known. Yes?
Which might explain to us where Eliezer
Berkowitz fits in. Eliezer Berkowitz, Rabbi Rubin is the expert on Eliezer Berkowitz, but it's not for now. But I'll only tell you, Eliezer Berkowitz, No, he was not JTS. No, Eliezer Berkowitz was, let's put it this way, he was caught on the borderline between Gerber Toshav and certain issues, one issue in particular, Geirut, for instance. See, he suffered on that issue with the Kabbalat Mitzvot. And there you find them on the borderline.
Well, he was ready to accept the
Diyevet. Yeah, right. So you can be, let me just see, Sam, you can be Malamit Schot. Rabbi Rubin will give you a lecture, but I'll tell you. But one second. With Afkot Kedushin, you got to understand that he suffered. Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg came out with a proposal, Eliezer Berkowitz came out with a proposal of... I can't go into it now, it would take hours. I lectured on it extensively, on Sveik Sveika, on coming in with two aspects to enable a get out a kedushin al tanai, and coming in with two aspects to turn it into a sveik sveika. Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg gave haskama to his proposal. And finally, there was such an outcry against Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, he had to tone down the haskama. That left deep scars on Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. I would say, to sum up, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, and I knew him, he lived on Rehov Chenechovsky, he was a wonderful individual, and he has great skuyot. He went down to the bomb shelter on the Blitz in London, carrying Rabbi Chiel Yaakov's writings with him. Two-thirds of the original Sri Deyesh is the result of what he saved. You understand? He didn't carry food, he didn't carry drink, he carried Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg's writings. I would describe Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, he would be very happy in the more right-wing element of Chobevei Torah. Yes, what do you think, Yitz? You think that's a valid, good description?
He was doing it because the war had just ended and he was trying to free up Abunot. Wasn't that a big driver?
No, not again. He was trying to deal with the problem of the husband who refuses to give a get.
He was also, didn't he have to deal with a lot of people that...
Reb Lazer Berkowitz, I know he was a posek. Reb Shlomo David Kahana was the big posek with Agunot. Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Yitzhak Isaac Alevi Herzog. As far as I know, Reb Lazer Berkowitz went to... That's before World War II. I don't know if he dealt with it. I dealt with it in class when I dealt with Sahal. Wait, I have to get that. Ellie, I have to deal with... One second, I have to reveal secrets in a second. Give me 1 second. I had so much to do this morning. He's the famous story. I mean, all right, let's tell the truth. It changes history and changes the Soloveitchik family suffers until today. What happened was in the mid-60s, if only David Applebaum were here, I'd have David tell you the story, because David used to say to me, he says, Rabaron, for you it's history. For me it's painful. I lived it. So Reb Lazer Berkowitz was teaching at the Hebrew Theological College at BMT in Skokie, what you call Skokie. Reb Lazer Berkowitz was teaching there. Reb Chaim Zimmerman was the Rosh Yeshiva. At the Purim Chagiga, I don't know the exact words, but it goes something like this. I may not be absolutely correct, but you get the feeling. Reb Chaim Zimmerman says, Professor Berkowitz, I want to say Torah, and I have what to say, and even my friend, the biggest apikoros around, Professor Berkowitz, will agree with me. And Berkowitz threw a dish at Reb Chaim Zimmerman, and all pandemonium broke out, and the board of directors met the next day and fired Reb Chaim Zimmerman. Now that's how, and then they offered the Rosh Yeshiva ship to Rabban Soloveitchik. And, you know, that's open to discussion. It probably was a very bad decision to go there, because the Balabatim ruled the yeshiva, not Rabban. And then it came to the famous story, the Mizrahi had a shul, a little building, and that part of Chicago, native Chicagoans can tell you exactly where, that part of Chicago changed, the neighborhood changed, and they had to get rid of the building, and they sold it, I believe, to a Buddhist temple. And Rabban Asad selling it, Aveda Zara. And the Balabatim told Rabban to go fly a kite. And Rabban put the Balabatim in the Chveis, fought with them. I don't use the word Chayrim, but he fought loud and clear, and the Balabatim fired him. And that's how Rabban comes to organize Yeshivat Brisk. Now, when he organizes Yeshivat Brisk, he pulls away a lot of students like David Applebaum from Skokie, who come with Rabban to the new Yeshivat Brisk. And here there's a very sad story. I never researched all the details, but I have the story essentially correct. The brisker element in English wine got very upset with Reb Aaron because they were worried it would cut into fundraising. The world would not differentiate between brisk in Chicago and brisk in Jerusalem. And certain Rosh Yeshiva from, I believe it was Tells in Cleveland, called Reb Aaron and conveyed their agony, negative feelings towards Reb Aaron because of what he did. And they started yelling at each other. And Reb Aaron said, what? They don't have a monopoly in brisk. I'm also a brisker. And everyone will know this is brisk Chicago, not brisk in Yerushalayim. But Reb Aaron got very upset. And it was about a half hour later he had the stroke. And the family, those of you who know Reb Yosef Halevi Soloveitchik, and Reb Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik, Reb Elio Halevi Soloveitchik, Nebuch, you can get the story until today. So that essentially is tales out of Chicago. Now a tale out of Lakewood. Excuse me?
It's the same problem. They have a thing in Chicago too.
Well, who has the same problem?
The tales in Chicago too.
No, the tales in Chicago is very successful today. But the tells in Cleveland went down, and people say it's an onish. I don't want to play God.
What's
I don't know.
No,
because what happened with Reb Aaron Soloveitchik? It's a very serious story. Let me just say, first of all, what did we do today? We finished up academic freedom. Mordechai Kaplan, impossible to solve that problem. How do you tone Kaplan down? How do you get rid of him? The students loved him, and I actually found letters. Listen very carefully. I actually found letters. I produced some of these letters in Rakaf Ved Aharon. It's my research in postdoctoral research in Michael, published by Tel Aviv View. I actually found letters where the leaders of the Balabatim, who were Reform, said if we only could have gotten rid of Kaplan, we could have solved the problem. We would have had one institution, money for one institution, but we couldn't find a way to solve the Mordechai Kaplan problem. There would have been a rebellion. It's like, why are you today? There was once talk, get rid of one Rosh Yeshiva. You can't do it. He's popular with the students. When you're popular with the students, you can't get rid of the Rebbe. A Rebbe depends upon students. When the students say the Rebbe is great, you can't touch the Rebbe. And it's like the Rav. What made the Rav the Rav? Ellie, I just want to tell you, you were right. We spoke about David Hartman last week. And we have someone here who was, imagine, who was in Montreal when Dibi made that famous statement, an ear witness. But you're right. We spoke about Tisha B'Av, go home, turn on the lights, put the parochet back. Say that. You're right. It began already in Lakewood. I don't know Chaim Berlin, I know Dibi from Lakewood. So it began in Lakewood. I'll tell you an interesting story, which I've never told before. Every syllable is absolutely true. In 54, I learned in Lakewood. Between the summer, I went back during the year. And then, as I like in Washington, my parents put heat on me that I have to go to YUR for a year, right? We agreed, right? You've read Washington, the one-year deal, fine. So I went back to Lakewood in 55. And it was very uncomfortable because Reb Aaron accepted us, even though I told Reb Aaron that I have to give Yeshivas Chochanan a try. The students did not. They boycotted us. Some of them, not all, just some. So some of the YU guys who were there were very upset, and we went back. It reached Dubi's ears what had happened, and he made an appointment with Irvin Bunin. May mean anything to you, a fire in his soul, a fire in my soul. Amos Bunim's Zichrono Levracha, Amos, I knew from YU, his book about his father, beautiful book. So and Dibi took a few of us to go to Amos, to go to Irvin and state our complaints. I really didn't have complaints. I personally felt I can understand the Lakewood guys. They are sacrificing not going to college. They are willing to give up getting panasa. They're willing to give up what is so important to being an American. And that they can be angry at a guy like me who's going to give YU a try. But Dovi was livid with rage. We go to Irvin Bunim, and Dovi opens her mouth against Lakewood, what went on against Rabarin, hoping that Irvin Bunim could have influence on Rabarin. You understand what I'm saying? But I saw then the enmity was beginning towards the wells that had given him water, the cisterns that had sustained him. And I'm not surprised. I'm not. What happened afterwards was gradual, but you can see where the roots were. What surprises me is the enmity towards the Rav in his last volumes. Wow. But it shows you, as time moved on, he was angry at Chaim Berlin, angry at Lakewood, angry at Rabarin Kotler, and then ultimately angry at YU and furious at the Rav. But you're absolutely right, it was a gradual process. Okay, now, Yitzchak gave an order yesterday that the Rebbe should make copies. This is what we spoke about in class, the kuntres that came out on serving in the army and Lima Torah. Anyone interested, there are five copies here. Here's an original. Here are four copies. Four copies that I made. Anyone who wants, please take. You have a Hasidic soul. If anyone wants this, it hurts me to throw it out. It's fascinating. You learn about Hasidus, the Vishnitsa, what goes on with the Vishnitsa, the Ungarische. It's a whole book there, Xerox in front of your eyes. Now, one second. Let me give out what I have. I want to return this. I commented on this in class, I believe. I don't know if you were here or not. But I still stand on my theory that the Mishnah Berurah is a malakhed and the Aruch HaShulchan is a posek. You can have it. It's going to be very interesting to see. Gentlemen, I want to show you something. On my talk on the press conference, one of the people listening sent me this, commenting on my comments.
No joke.
Whoever, Yitzchak, you can have this, but you don't think it back. You just have to promise to read it.
I'll read it.
I want you, because I responded.
Comments on the comments?
Right, and the two articles he encloses.
We have comments afterwards.
Okay. Well, and that now. No, he quibbles with me, but he's a very fine individual, and I let him have it. But good, I said, you're a Talmud, he's a big Talmud Chacham. I said, you have to keep on learning of your Talmud, but you have to be honest. Don't double talk. This business with the Petitza Bekeh, don't try to tell me that the Yashiv didn't approve the letter that was published by Chayab. This is the latest tradition. There's a fabulous article here on Yitzchak, 1 second. My long, lonely journey to the Rav.
Who's that?
Every Jew should read this article. It opens your eyes. If anyone wants it, pass it on.
You may say it.
No, I read it.
Here is the latest Mayan with an article, very fascinating article. First of all, there's an article by a Soloveitchik in Chachmat Yisrael.
Really?
I don't know who the Soloveitchik is. Yisrael Baruch Soloveitchik. If anyone knows who he is, let me know. Secondly, there's an article by Rabbi Levinger on a topic that Rabbi Weiss just covers in one of his public talks. Chickens, shalavim. Chickens with chickens without feathers. Kosher or they're developing it now. Kosher or not kosher. You know what it means, chickens without feathers? It means that you don't have to clean them all. It will make chickens so much cheaper. What a she'ela.
The chicken is born frozen.
Right. It's unbelievable. Okay, so I've given out what I want to give out this week. If anyone wants the shach, copies of the shach left. And now, one word of Musa. Gentlemen, yesterday's class was 1,000 times more important than today's class. Why is it? I have a bigger attendance today than yesterday. No wonder we have Bahab. You guys have to do Bahab to be Balei Tshuva. Yesterday's class was 1,000,000 times more important. The heart of Pesach. And now we're going to come back to that Pesach a little bit more. And next week what we're doing with the Oraita and the Rabbanan. And I have to look for students with candles. And Heintvassich of Geret Nayushkeit with Menachem Mendel Kaplan. It's a full house. Gentlemen, until we meet again, a very meaningful Yom HaZikaron, a very happy Yom HaTzmut, until we meet again on health and happiness, Das Vedanya.